our agenda today.
Good.
Which is a reduced agenda.
Good.
Here it is. We're going to start with a work session on House Bill 2112. Colleagues, House Bill 2112 is a bill that you have not really spent any time with in this committee, because I loaned this bill through the process we have to the E-Government Committee, and they held extensive hearings. Hearings extensive enough that what you have before you, as I understand it, in the Dash 4 amendments, is a replacement version of the bill. This is the bill, for those of you who have been following this issue a little bit, there are two sort of acronym bills floating around in the computer world. One is called UCITA. That bill had a hearing earlier this week, and that bill is not being moved. Then there is a bill called UETA, and this is the UETA bill. We've got Jim Craven from the American Electronics Association and Tom Barman from the Oregon State Bar. And I'd like if you two gentlemen could both come forward and maybe just take a minute or so each explaining what this bill is attempting to accomplish and maybe how the process worked in the e-government committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association, and with me is Tom Barman here, representing the Oregon State Bar. What you have before you is a bill that allows and makes very clear under Oregon State law that electronic signatures are legal and are a legal substitute for in-writing types of contracts. The bill, UETA, Uniform Electronics Transaction Act, is a model law. It comes from the group NACUSL, the National Commission on Whatever Uniform State Laws group, that it has been adopted by
27 states.
27 states to date. It's been out for a couple years and has been moving around the country. We didn't have a chance to consider it last session, but it is a bill that most states that have considered it have adopted. What happened last year in Congress is the U.S. Congress passed something referred to as the E-Sign Act, which is a federal statute basically clarifying the law of the land that electronic signatures are legal and have the full force of law when used in transactions. What Congress said, because UETA, this model state law, had already been bouncing around, already passed a couple dozen states when Congress acted last year, Congress said that states could go ahead and continue to adopt UETA if they chose to. But if they did, they had to adopt UETA pretty much the straight version of UETA. They couldn't just say, this is the model law, but we're going to make wholesale changes to it. So what Congress said is you have a choice. You can just defer to the federal law, or you as a state can continue to adopt UETA, but you have to adopt it pretty much in the version that we want you to. Little issue of federal-state preemption that went on. So what you have in front of you, House Bill 2112, essentially, the Dash 4 amendments are a substitute version of the bill. So Dash 4s essentially are the entire bill. We worked on this for a number of months in Representative Jim Hill's Advancing E-Government Committee, where the participants included American Electronics Association, the Oregon State Bar, a number of private practice attorneys, the Attorney General's Office, Department of Administrative Services. I guess that was the most of the players. And we had at least three hearings and a few iterations of the bill. And what you have before you, I believe I can represent as a consensus version of the bill that all those parties I mentioned have agreed to. So what we do, the key thing that we did in this bill, sections 1 through 21 are basically the national model law for UETA. There was a concern by a number of parties, including the Attorney General, that there are some specific consumer protection provisions found in the federal law that are not found in UETA. And a number of Attorneys General around the country have said that we don't want to miss some of those important consumer protection provisions found in the federal law. So in the construction of the bill, Those consumer protection provisions are incorporated in Section 24. Just Section
Correct.
24.
Section 24.
Basically what you have in are Sections 1 through 21 are UEDA. Then you have some other cleanup provisions. We, three sessions ago adopted a digital signatures law in Oregon, and part of this is just getting the terminology right. So there's a couple of cleanup provisions here in the bill that that pick up some of those terminologies that are in current law, as well as the consumer protections from the federal e-sign bill. So that's the package. You have UEDA, you have some cleanup from current Oregon law, and you have the insertion of the consumer protection provisions in Section 24. So basically, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think this bill is good to go. We'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have to the extent of our ability to do so.
Mr. Barman, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Just to clarify, the primary reason for all of the Dash 4 amendments was to, Jim Craven indicated, was to clean up the original bill to make it as consistent with UEDA as possible. There is concern that if you're not entirely consistent, that that bill can be held invalid as not correctly following the strict requirements of e-sign. So the primary reason for the Dash 4 amendments was just to try and make it as clean and conforming with UEDA as possible, and then also, as Jim indicated, to bring forward the consumer protection provisions out of e-sign into UEDA, and just incorporate the text of that into Oregon law. One other small cleanup in the Dash 4s are references or the definitions related to the crime of forgery, to make sure that crime now also incorporates anything related to electronic records and contracts in addition to standard hard copy contracts and records. So, happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions, Representative Ringo?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if you could give me a 30-second summary of what the potential risks to the consumer are that this section tries to address. It looks like it has to do with withdrawal of consent is the main issue.
UEDA is a opt-in statute, meaning that in order to have legal effect, both parties to the agreement have to opt in and agree to conduct a transaction by electronic means. That opt-in part can happen just by conduct. So if I send somebody a record and they respond, a record electronically and they respond electronically, you might determine that by their conduct they agree to conduct transactions that way. The consumer protection provisions are just to make sure that consumers don't, at some point by their conduct, consent to do transactions electronically, and then all of a sudden they're starting to get foreclosure notices, eviction notices, power termination notices, that type of thing, electronically, where they may not be as aware of those notices. So in certain cases, even where the consumer has consented, we require an extra step ensuring that the consumer is notified about those notices.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ringo, that was some of the concern in the congressional debate. From our point of view, we think some of the concern might have been a little overblown, but in order to address those issues, there was some debate in Congress about somebody getting an email telling them that their loan amount had changed and they had changed their ISP provider, and then the bank would call their loan and foreclose on them. It's probably the kind of thing that wouldn't happen in real life, but to just be absolutely certain that was not going to happen out there, with bank loans and utility notices, those explicit provisions were inserted in the federal law.
Further questions? Representative Vicki Walker.
I know.
Okay. You just had your pen up. Okay.
Yeah, and nodding, and I like that provision in the law that he was just stating. I think that's really important.
Anyone else? Thank you both for coming up and helping us understand this a little bit better. Is there anyone else here who has anything to add on UEDA that feels like they'd like to inform the committee? Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. The chair would move the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2112. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Amendments are adopted. Chair would move House Bill 2112 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
Shannon, would you call the roll? I guess I should ask, did anybody want to discuss that? Okay, Shannon?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Stafford?
Aye.
Representative Dingfelman?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Excuse.
Representative Vicki Walker?
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lowe?
Excused. Do I get to vote, Shannon? Okay, aye. Just checking. Representative Walker, before I bang the gavel, we have just adopted the amendments to House Bill 2112 and have moved the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It is the revised version of UEDA, not UCETA, but UEDA, the Uniform Signature Electronic Transactions Act that was worked heavily by the e-government committee as we loaned them the bill. And so far, all the votes have ran unanimous, if that gives you any...
Well, shall we make it unanimous then?
All right. Representative Walker is an aye. Bill will move to the floor. Because most of the work on this bill was done in the e-government committee, it would be my intent to assign Representative Low,
she's on the committee.
Because she's on both committees,
right,
to carry the bill. That's a great idea, Representative Walker.
She'll be thrilled. Even, and she's not here, so...
Exactly.
My guess is she attended most of those other meetings. We're now going to open a work session on House Bill 2356. Council?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2356 creates a state commission on court facilities. You should have just had passed out to you the Dash 2 amendments, which replace the original bill. I spoke to the fiscal officer, or the fiscal office, and they're not prepared to give us a fiscal yet. There's still some controversy over this bill, and I believe we have a couple of people here that probably need to explain the Dash 2 amendments and where we're going.
Thank you. Brad and Paul, do you two want to come forward? Is there coming up, committee, just to refresh your recollection about this bill, you will recall...
We haven't had anything on this.
We had a hearing on this bill,
no.
Even? How are we working this bill before having
it? It didn't get scheduled. I accidentally scheduled it just for a work session and not for a hearing.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
That's how
we do that. All right. Well, let me tell you then, committee, just a little bit of background. All of you are aware of the situation we have in this state with respect to court facilities. We have numerous county courthouses around Oregon that are lacking in the ability of the court facilities to provide the courts the actual facilities necessary to sometimes get the job done in an effective way, or to accommodate the addition of new judges or court staff. We've had testimony over the years, Representative Shetterly, in the last session we had a bill not unlike this one in some respects, I think, where the issue was discussed. And frankly, and I'll just be real blunt about it, I think there is a tension between the court system and the counties as to who bears and ought to bear the ultimate burden for dealing with that issue. Back at the in the beginning of the 80s, when the court system took over from the counties the indigent defense program and hired all the county court staff, which essentially then became state employees, The understanding at that time by at least some people was that that meant that the counties would be responsible for the buildings and the facilities as part of that trade-off. Obviously, the counties have been impacted over the years by Measure 5 and Measure 4750, there's just been, I think, a lot of tension surrounding this issue. This bill, recognizing that we weren't going to have any money this session to actually address the fundamental problem and not knowing the extent of the problem in a consistent way to address, this bill would create a state commission on core facilities, which would develop a recommendation to the next legislature, as I believe the bill is written, on how to potentially address this problem. That being said, there is still some, as I understand it, points of disagreement even between the counties and the state court system with respect to this version of the amendments that you have in front of you. I thought this issue was resolved, having met personally with Mike McClure, the head of AOC, and the Chief Justice in my office probably not more than a week ago, but I understand there is now another point of controversy. So giving you that background, committee, and the time that we have left to get bills moving out of this process, it's my intent to work this today with these two gentlemen, figure out what the problem is, make a call on what we want to do with this, and send it down to the Ways and Means Committee as quickly as we can, so there might still be some chance to get something done. So with that, I'm going to give Paul, you the first shot to talk to us a little bit. Representative Krieger.
I'm going to have to leave the letter from Loma County. Their concerns, you've got that was directed to you.
From Multnomah County?
Yeah, library.
The library.
I don't have a copy of it.
That's actually, I think that's old. I think that the issues that were raised in that letter have been resolved with actually the dash one amendments, but now we're on to the dash two.
Okay, I'm going to have to get it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if we might, I'd request that Commissioner Johnstone join us at on the panel to discuss the policy issues from the perspective of AOC.
Okay, please. And I want to say I laid that out fairly quickly, and to the extent that any one of you want to disagree with my recitation of the background on this issue, I won't be offended. You're welcome to disagree with my recitation at any time. Please, identify yourself for the record.
Chair Williams, for the record, my name is Rob Johnstone. I'm chairman of the Yamhill County Board of Commissioners.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. I don't disagree at all with your description of the history. I'd like to add a couple of points in addition to that, Mr. Chair, that I think are relevant. In 1981, in a special session, the legislature passed legislation under which it took over the operational costs of the state trial court system. During the regular session, just before that, all the work was done. The special session was one day long, and it dealt with one particular issue, and that was it. During the regular session, the legislature took into account and worked from this report of the Commission on the Judicial Branch. And it was a commission that I believe was created in 1977 or 79. It resulted in the legislation which was ultimately passed, and the executive director of the Commission on the Judicial Branch at that time was Dennis Bromka. In the Commission on the Judicial Branch wrote its report, and with respect to this issue, it said this is the one that gives us the most difficulty. And it went on to say that for the reasons of, first of all, we basically can't afford to take over this additional cost of the facilities as well, and because we really don't know what to do with a multi-purpose building in which county offices are placed, in which state offices are placed, and we've got court systems, we're just going to leave it this way. Counties will continue to have the operational cost responsibilities for the facilities for the buildings, and the state will take over the operation of the courts. In March of 81, Dennis Bromka, who was the executive director of the Commission on the Judicial Branch, was presenting this legislation to the House Judiciary Committee. And he was going through it section by section. When he got to this section, he had a dialogue with then-Representative Courtney, in which Representative Courtney said, well, what is it with these buildings? What are you going to do with them? And Mr. Bromka described how the bill would work, And Representative Courtney said, that surprises me. And Mr. Branca's response to that was, well, it's not the best system. I'm paraphrasing. Any rational person would make this a part of the unified court system, but for the reasons that are described in the report, we can't do it now. And so that's the way the problem was left. I think the chair has very well described some of the things that have happened since then that have impacted the problem and frankly made it much worse. Measure 5, Measure 47, Measure 50, Measure 5, all three of those measures and ONC forest receipt problems and federal forest receipt problems have all adversely impacted counties. I might add that Measure 5 has significantly impacted the state by providing a huge cost shift for schools. So we're both in a posture right now where the financial circumstances are tougher than they used to be. And with respect to this issue, we have a growing problem. And we've been working with the Judicial Department now for several years in a joint task force to try to address this problem. And the printed bill was an effort that moved us in the direction that we thought we could go. Our legislative committee looked at the printed bill and said, there are problems with this, we can't go there. This is inappropriate and it puts us too far, it puts us in a position where we could be 2 years down the road where we're worse off than we are today. And for those reasons and more that Commissioner Johnstone will describe, we worked with the Dash 1 amendments, discussed the issue with the Judicial Department, made further changes in the Dash 1 amendments and present to you the Dash 2 amendments. Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to now turn this over to Commissioner Johnstone to describe further these issues that we've dealt with.
Commissioner? Chair Williams, thank you. I've worked on this issue now for about 3 years as part of the Association of Oregon Counties task force working on this. And during that time, we've also worked very closely with the Judicial Department in a joint task force to try to address mutual interests in this. The court clearly have an interest in putting some definition to the term that's currently in statute that calls for the counties to provide facilities that are suitable and sufficient. There currently is no definition to that. There are no minimum standards, and the court would like for there to be some definition to create those, and we're not in disagreement with that. The county's primary motivation in all of this is to try to find some kind of financial relief for the growing burden of providing those suitable and sufficient facilities, even without the minimum standards defined currently. And as the court system grows, that creates an even greater burden on local government to not only provide for additional space for new judges that are created in the judicial districts, but also just to simply maintain existing facilities, many of which are in quite serious disrepair. Anyone that's traveled the state and looked at the conditions of the courthouse and the court facilities across the state will come away with the conclusion that there's a wide disparity among counties on state court facilities. Some of them are clearly suitable and sufficient, others clearly are not. And so to help remedy that, we have worked toward this bill, which creates a state commission that would inventory, that would have several charges, one of which is to inventory the condition of facilities across the state court facilities, and then to recommend some minimum standards to another session of the legislature for possible adoption. One of the concerns that the counties have is that if we put definition to the minimum standards, that will create an additional burden above and beyond the ones that currently exist with the less clearly defined suitable and sufficient. And so to that end, our concern is not that we create an additional burden to ourselves, but find, along with this state commission, charging them with recommending to the legislature to identify a funding stream in addition to county general fund dollars to help comply with whatever minimum standards end up being identified. And so the original House Bill 2356 came out of our joint task force with the with commissioners and with judges and representatives from the state court administrator's office, and even the Chief Justice himself met a number of times with that committee, trying to identify mutual interests and craft a bill that addresses both of our issues. Come up with some minimum standards and also try to provide some way to work towards granting some financial relief from the growing burden on counties to provide these facilities. And out of that that work group, that joint task force, over the last year and a half, we came up with House Bill 2356. Now, I'm under orders from the Association of Oregon Counties, the legislative committee that meets and has to sign off and approve any legislative agenda that we may have or priority, to that whatever we come up with meets with their collective interest. And when we presented 2356 to our committee in January, it wasn't going to fly. There were a number of concerns that as long as counties remain responsible for the provision, the funding of maintaining court facilities and even complying with minimum standards if they're enacted, there is no provision for additional dollars. And so that was a problem. And they asked us to take the bill and rework it to put in some safeguards that if we get minimum standards, at least the counties don't go backwards and create a worse problem than we had before. And out of that, we identified a couple of things that we made changes that became the Dash 1 amendments that passed muster with our legislative committee that charged the State Commission with finding a funding stream other than county general funds to help comply with whatever minimum standards were enacted. That seemed to be one of the big sticking points. When we came up with the Dash 1 amendments, that's where we kind of got sideways with the Judicial Department. They were not supportive of those, and I don't mean to, Brad's going to be able to address those himself, so I don't want to mischaracterize them, but their position, but I think that their concern was that it appeared that with the language we incorporated into the Dash 1s, it looked like counties were looking to actually shirk their responsibility for working with the courts to help comply with some standards, and that clearly is not the case. We believe that we are in partnership with the state. The counties are political subdivisions of the state of Oregon. We've got a very long history of working together. The counties are the primary delivery system of many state services across a broad spectrum of issues, not only courts, but health and human services, transportation issues, a variety of different issues. And so we were a little taken aback because we believe that we're in it for the long haul. We also recognize that the Judicial Department, in its Justice 2020 document, where they envision what the court system would look like by the year 2020, which when it was produced a few years ago, looked like it was a long way into the future, but it goes much more rapidly than all of us realize at the time. There was no roadmap to allow the state to get to what its stated vision was, and that was to either own or lease all of the facilities they occupy by the year 2020. But there is no plan to make that happen, and so we have worked with the Judicial Department to try to come up with that plan to begin taking some steps moving towards realizing that goal. And in the last session, we advocated for House Bill 2317 that passed that allowed the state, the courts to attach interest on uncollected criminal judgments that we anticipate will generate about $500,000 in revenue per biennium, which isn't much, but it is a step. And we believe that this bill is the next step in helping to identify the conditions of the courts, what needs to happen, but also charge the State Commission with identify a funding source other than simply saddling on the backs of the counties. And so that's why we had the Dash 1 amendments. We're not looking to shirk our responsibility. We're looking to work in partnership with the state. And when we had a brief little work session with the administrator for this committee a couple of weeks ago, it looked that like we were at an impasse, that there was no room for negotiation at all. We left that meeting and sat down and came up with some additional language that I would have to get approved by AOC's legislative committee. We didn't have time to meet, so I ran those by our executive committee, which has the authority to agree to any changes. And they weren't substantive changes in terms of what the bill necessarily does to or for either side, but simply clarifies the county's intent to continue to work with the state. And that's what came out of that is the Dash 2 amendments, which says that when the State Commission looks to a funding source, the Dash 1 say that the funding source has to be other than county general funds. The Dash 2 amendments say in addition to county funds, to clarify that it is our intent to cooperate and continue to work with the state and be a partner in this for the long term. One other change was, one of the concerns seemed to be that the the presiding judges, the courts, were basically cut out of any decisions on spending county general fund dollars or any new dollars that came as a result of the passage of this bill, that the money could be spent. Their perspective was the money could be spent by anything the counties chose to do, and we made it very clear that the judges would be cut out of a decision on how the money is spent. We made it very clear that we expected the counties and the local judges to cooperate with the state commission in providing the plans. So those are, and as well as one of the other concerns was that because the original bill included a general fund appropriation for staffing the state commission, and we don't have clear numbers on that, we've got a ballpark in the $85,000 to $90,000 range, that maybe that alone was a deal killer once the thing got in front of Ways and Means. And so we made a change in that, indicating that if the modest increase in criminal fines and that are written into this were approved, that we anticipate would generate perhaps $3 million per buy-in, and we would be willing to allow money out of those funds to be used to staff the state commission so there would be no general fund dollars going for that purpose. So that's what we've done with the Dash 2 amendments. We believe that we've clarified our intent to be good partners with the state in this, and we're getting anecdotal evidence all over the state that the county facilities are in a difficult position. The funding decisions having to be made as all of us in the local government are going through our budget process, just as you are here, are having to make some very tough decisions because of limited revenue. And as long as we have discretion without a particular mandate, we're going to have to make some tough decisions that may impact everybody, and some of it could end up being facilities maintenance, and we're hoping that that doesn't happen. We've, in Yamhill County, worked very closely with our presiding judge, addressing virtually all of their facilities needs in a timely manner, but that's not necessarily the case in all counties, and I'm hoping that with the Dash 2 amendments that we can take the next step in helping to address this issue to the county satisfaction, as well as helping to advance the interests of the Justice Department and getting some direction on standards towards suitable and sufficient.
Thank you. Paul.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just a couple comments about the Dash 2 amendments. These amendments are not the solution to the problem. They are intended to create a process to identify the solution to the problem and somewhat mitigate the current hemorrhaging that we're all experiencing. But with respect to what the Dash 2 amendments do, just very briefly, they create an 11-member state commission, two people appointed by the President of the Senate, one from each party, two people appointed by the Speaker of the House, one from each party, three people appointed by the Chief Justice, who would be judges or employees or members of the state bar, employees of the judicial branch or members of the state bar. The governor would appoint four, three of whom would be county people, one of whom would be a public member. The commission would be staffed by the Department of Administrative Services. This is a bare-bones budget, and we've worked with DAS to find out what the cost would be to staff and to operate the commission. We're somewhere around $86,000, assuming 24 meetings. Actually, we think there will be fewer than 24 meetings in the next biennium, so it would probably be even less than that. We authorize the State Commission to seek and expend grants and other funding sources in the event they could find any additional funds to perform their work. It directs both counties and local trial court administrators to cooperate with the Commission in identifying the physical condition of the local facilities and the fiscal impact of proposed standards. With respect to the proposed standards, it directs the State Commission to take into account the local circumstances, both the condition of the local facility, the condition of other facilities in the same building, and the financial circumstances of the community that they're looking at. So that basically we're trying to avoid a situation where state standards are created in the abstract and imposed in a situation that makes the whole thing ridiculous. With respect to other functions of the State Commission, it's to identify what additional facilities are needed and where, to look at funding sources for the additional facilities. As Commissioner Johnstone mentioned, the Vision 2020 document that was prepared by the Judicial Department says that the vision is for the state to own or lease the facilities it occupies, the Judicial Department, by the year 2020. There's no roadmap to get there. There's no plan B. And so what this is intended to do is to have the commission take a look at this issue and say, okay, is that where you want to go? If it's not where you want to go, where do we want to go? And how are we going to get there and how are we going to pay for it? On page 3, top of the page, subparagraph B, the commission is to look at changes in facility utilization that might alleviate the need for additional court facilities. This is best practices. It's intended to take a look at how the courts operate, how the counties operate in the same facility, and figure out ways to do things better so as to mitigate the need for additional facilities if we can do that. Section 3 requires the State Commission to report to the next legislative session. Section 4 creates a local facilities account for the additional funding that's created in later sections of the bill, and it dedicates that money only for the provision and maintenance of state courtrooms, court facilities, and jury rooms. Section 5 provides a vehicle for the funding source, and Section 6 provides the funding source itself. It's an increase in the county assessment in criminal cases. The amount of the increase is yet to be determined. We did something similar to this a few years ago when we created the law enforcement medical liability account. If we were to duplicate that same increase, it would provide $3 million per biennium. The bill also provides later on, again in Section 8, the money can be used only to pay the cost of, well, in addition to providing for the facilities and cells, it can be used to pay the debt service on bonds, certificates of participation, or other things that are used to improve the facilities themselves. And the commission itself is sunsetted after 4 years, so that we give it an opportunity to get everything done and then sunset the commission itself.
Thanks, Paul. Brad?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. And actually, I can't disagree with anything either Paul or Commissioner Johnston have said, or the chair's summary of what's gone on. We actually believe that it's a very, court facilities is a very important issue that's sort of been languishing for a while. It's an issue that needs to be resolved. We think that it probably can only be resolved by the counties and the courts working together to bring proposals to the legislature to address these issues, which is why we've worked so hard for the last, this has been an ongoing issue for a number of years, but particularly the last 18 to 24 months with the counties to try and come up with a proposal. Needless to say that we worked for during the interim with the counties on a proposal, and we were somewhat surprised at the end of the interim when they couldn't accept the proposal that we'd worked on with them for 18 months. And that was the original bill that was introduced. Since then, they've introduced amendments, most of which I think have gone a long way to solve the problems that we had with the original Dash 1 amendments. Let me sort of cut to the chase and tell you what still remains as an issue for us. The Dash 2 amendments, which I think is what we're really talking about, do three things. It sets up a state commission to bring this issue back before the legislature in the next session in a posture that the legislature will be able to deal with it, with recommended funding sources, recommended standards, sort of a county by county assessment of where the facilities are, and an approach to come back and address to this. It also sets up a funding source, and that funding source does two things. It provides money to pay for the commission, which is important because there may in fact not be money in the general fund to do that. And it may create additional funds for the counties in the interim to spend on court facilities. The remaining issue between us, and it has been a point from the very beginning, is that we believe, the Judicial Department believes, that any new monies that are generated through the state court system and given to the counties for purposes of addressing facilities issues also need to be, the spending of those monies need to be addressed in a cooperative manner. That it's not just an issue for the counties how those are spent, it's also an issue for the courts how they are spent. So we believe that for new monies that are generated through this bill that are going to the counties, there needs to be agreement on how those are spent at the local court level. Now, in most counties, this isn't going to be an issue because in most counties, there's cooperation, some level of cooperation between the court and the counties about facilities. We understand that counties don't always have the money, but they try and work things out. In some counties, it is an issue. There isn't a great deal of cooperation. Part of it is because there isn't necessarily a great deal of money, and the demand always exceeds the supply. But our remaining reservation with this part of the bill, or with the proposed Dash 2 amendments, is that when you get to the new monies that are generated under this provision, how the monies are spent is totally at the discretion of the counties. We believe that the new monies need to be spent in accordance with an agreement worked out between the local presiding judge and the counties. And that's our remaining disagreement with the Dash 2 amendments. We understand that the amount of monies that are to be generated is something that will be developed in ways and means based on projections and those sorts of things. But we believe this issue, the issue of whether or not there has to be agreement on this expenditure of any new local monies that are developed for the counties to expend, is a substantive issue that may not be addressable in ways and means. And they would look, of course, to the substantive committee to address that issue, which is why we raise that issue here. Other than that, we think the Dash 2 amendments address the concerns that we've raised. That's a big sticking point with the presiding judges and with the judicial department.
Thanks, Brad. Brad, tell me where in the bill does it authorize the counties to do this without any
level? Section 4 of the bill. It's on the Dash 2 amendments. It starts on page 3, lines 29, and runs through page 4, line 6, and there's no provision in there for requiring agreement of the local presiding judge. In the original bill, there had been sections that ran that had the money spent according to a plan that was developed by the local, what used to be the local court security committee, and it was renamed in the original bill, and that committee is comprised of a lot of different entities, including police and counties and those sorts of things, put together by the presiding judge. And the expenditure of the monies under the current court security plan requires the consent of both the county and the presiding judge in order to be spent. And anyway, it's Section 4 of this bill that does not make provision for that.
Okay. Questions of the committee? To any of these gentlemen? Representative Cheryl Walker.
I have a copy of a letter that was sent to you in regards to the law libraries.
Yeah,
I was out of the room a moment.
We talked about
okay,
that.
Thank you.
I think the law library problem got wrong. is gone.
Okay.
That issue is taken care of by the amendments.
Second question.
Yes.
The effect on the justice courts. Since lots of times the justice courts aren't, you know, located within the same facility. Is there going to be an effect on those, or are they going to be included as far as the assessments?
Anybody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, justice courts and municipal courts and state courts would all collect the county assessment, but the justice courts otherwise are unaffected by the bill.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just to all of you, I obviously support the concept that's before us as it relates to court facilities. My question is whether you're would also consider, under the definition of court facilities, the necessary technological infrastructure which could be available by the courts, or whether we should amend the bill to give this commission that authority to make those inquiries. Let me just make a brief statement as to why I think that's necessary. The bill only relates to court facilities, yet we do know that there's a lot of technological infrastructure that can be used these days in the court system to more fully utilize our court facilities. And I'll just give you one example. In Lane County, we have a courtroom in the jail. so that for security purposes, a court can go over there and conduct arraignments in-house and avoid the transportation of defendants back and forth to the courtroom. In Douglas County, arraignments are held in the jail, however, by a TV monitor. The judge doesn't have to go over there. He can utilize, or he or she can utilize, his own courtroom and just turn on the monitor and conduct arraignments in open court through technological processes. If that existed in Lane County, we'd eliminate we'd eliminate one courtroom or utilize it in a different fashion. But in any event, I'm wondering if your definition of court facilities includes or excludes the technological infrastructure which may be which could contribute to court efficiency.
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, currently I think this bill is designed primarily to address issues over which counties have the responsibility for costs currently related to courts. Currently, when you talk about technology, if it is court technology, unless the state bears the full responsibility for the technology that courts have, unless counties wish to provide it on their own or we're working on some kind of cooperative agreement as between the counties and whatever, but they have no, if it's a pure technology issue, computers, electronics, those sorts of things, it's not currently something that the counties have a statutory obligation to pay. And so I'm not sure that I think the original bill was intended to address those things that the counties have an obligation to pay. In some instances, they have been willing to partner to work on those kinds of issues, but that's purely a better government kind of thing, not something that they have an obligation to do. Does that answer your question?
Not exactly. My question is whether this commission would also consider, within the definition of court facilities, any infrastructure which could be utilized to increase the efficiency of the facility or the court system.
If I could, Representative Ackerman, I think that, in my mind, that falls under the discussion, frankly, of the best practices part of this, which is how do you get the most utilization out of the courtroom and court facilities that you've got. And I think, I personally think, to a great degree, that technology argument is subsumed somewhat in the best practices concept. Maybe these gentlemen will disagree with me, but I think that's where a lot of that fits.
Well, I can. I would not want to have this debate within the commission. I think we should have the debate here. And I can see, because I know some judges are very, very conservative about using technology, and they will be on this commission, and they're going to say, we're talking court facilities, we're talking real estate, we're talking leases, we're not talking infrastructure. And you're going to have a debate upon that, and I think we should try to resolve that here.
Okay, fair enough.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I think the example that you gave is it's cooperation, it's mutual responsibility. In order to do video arraignment, you have to have the equipment in the jail, you have to have the equipment in the courtroom. The jail is the county's responsibility, the courtroom is the court's responsibility, and they work together to make that happen. I agree with the chair's description of what authority the commission would have. I think it's pretty broad. And I would expect that best practices would include that kind of thing, because those discussions are ongoing in a lot of counties. They save a lot of costs, a lot of trouble, a lot of security problems. You don't have to transport prisoners. You don't have to transport the lawyers. And so it's a win-win for everybody. And folks are working, I think, pretty diligently on that right now.
May I say something, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Shetterly had a question, and then
no,
Representative Wall.
I'm fine.
Oh, okay. Representative Wall?
Chairman, the Advancing Government Committee has been struggling with this notion as well, and I do believe that a certain amount of the judicial branch budget, justice budget, is being unscheduled until they come up with a plan that talks about some of these things. Also, all of the participants in the CJIS endeavors, enterprises, everybody is having their budget unscheduled until they come up with a plan that addresses the some of the technology needs of advancing e-government enterprise and bringing the courts
and other branches of the government, by the way, other agencies, more thoroughly into the modern 21st century. Perhaps we could direct Bill to talk with his counterparts on that committee to see whether or not a discussion ought to be held jointly with our committee and theirs on giving suggestions on what direction that discussion should take. Is that a possibility, Mr. Chair?
It could be. It could be. I'd be pleased to talk with Representative Hill a bit further about that. I guess I want to ask you, what's the problem if we included some sort of a consultation requirement with the presiding judges with respect to the expenditure of any additional funds? I mean, we're sort of blue-skying this issue a little bit, assuming that we'll actually have additional funds for anybody to actually argue about. And I don't mind, I guess, just telling you that, you know, I'm a bit frustrated with this whole issue, as you might imagine, and I thought that we had gotten it all somewhat to resolution when I met with all of your bosses, frankly, in my office. But I just wonder what the objection would be on line 2 of page 4 of the bill, after the word county, just inserting something like with consultation of the local presiding judge. In other words, what's the downside to consulting the local presiding judge when it comes to spending any of that money that you're going to be spending on the maintenance of state courtrooms, offices, and jury rooms? I mean, to a great extent, he's going to be the person who has the best idea of how to utilize those resources better. I mean, your facilities manager might have some of those ideas too, but my guess is the presiding judge is going to be able to tell you best where they've got problems and where they would spend the next good dollar to improve their facility. Do you have any objection to that?
Chair Williams, I certainly don't. I believe that we as counties fully intended that to happen, and to simply write that into the bill clarifies that intent, so I have no objection at all.
Brad, is that sufficient?
Rather than consultation, we would like agreement if that's possible.
Like what?
Rather than consultation, we would like agreement, because that's an issue.
Well, let me suggest my concern about agreement, Brad, and, you know, maybe a better lawyer on this committee or in this room than I could answer this question. But doesn't that get into a little bit of a powers problem? I mean, don't you have a powers problem if you've got a local presiding judge having to vote on how the money is spent on an issue that is really money that is within the purview of the county commission on how to spend? I mean, I think it creates a powers problem.
Well,
I'm not sure I can give a local presiding court judge sort of executive authority to determine how to spend money.
Chair Williams, in the original bill, the way that we addressed that issue was to have it spent according to a plan that was jointly developed. And that was how we addressed the issue, because the local security committee was developing the plan, and the plan needed to be approved by the presiding judge, and once they had the plan that they both cooperated in developing, that's how the monies would be spent. And it eliminates the problem you've got, and it was something that was worked out over a number of meetings of the interim work group that we were in to address that issue. And the concern is that some counties will say, I mean, there are some counties where the relationships aren't necessarily that good between the courts and the county commissioners, and our concern is that they will say, okay, we've consulted with you, now we're going to spend it this way. We believe the plan should be, for how it's spent, should be worked out with both of them, and then the county commission should work with it.
How do you respond, gentlemen, to that comment? I mean, you know, if we've got counties where the situation is to that point, and regardless of who's at fault, whether it's the county commission or whether it's the court that's at fault for the breakdown in that kind of a communication, if it was going to be resolved by some sort of a security and facilities committee at the county level that could come to an agreement on a plan and then the money be spent according to that plan, where's the failure in that model?
Chair Williams, if I can address that. One of our concerns, and one of the reasons why we went to some Dash 1 amendments and ultimately the Dash 2 was over this issue from the county's perspective, was that this is a county charge. We're on the hook for providing these facilities, and we're not looking to shirk that responsibility, but we want ultimately the decision on how those monies get spent and on what to rest with the people that are obligated by law to provide, to meet that obligation, and that's the counties. I think it would be irresponsible for the counties to ignore the advice of a presiding judge or trial court administrator regarding facilities needs if there's new money and if there are standards, and the obligation on the counties is to comply with those standards. It would be totally irresponsible for the counties to shirk that responsibility or to use the money for something other than what it was designated for as a part of this bill. And we're working in partnership on this, but as long as the counties are the ones on the hook and obligated by law to provide these facilities, we believe that the ultimate decision needs to rest with the Board of County Commissioners.
Chair. Representative Ringo.
Just a comment. I really find this distressing. I mean, the mission should be the same, and that's to provide judicial services to the public. And it seems like it's an inexcusable turf battle. And from somebody who hasn't been involved in the battle, it's surprising and distressing to me that it's not that we're not able to come together. Chair Williams, I think your suggestion makes sense to me. Just the consulting with, if you create a plan, then you're going to have arguments about how the plan is created, whether it's really complied with, are you acting in accordance with the plan, aren't you? There's too many discretionary matters there. That's my suggestion, Chair. It also was a comment. I just find this distressing.
Representative Backlund, and then Representative Cheryl Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Williams, I have a question for you, I guess. Is the term that you suggested, consulting, the legal term consulting, is that the same term that I would use as a non-lawyer typically?
Well, by consultation, I essentially meant that before they spent the money, they would have to go talk to the presiding judge about what the best way to spend the money would be. I think that's
What I thought, too.
Yeah, I think that's the standard term.
And, Mr. Chair, I guess the legislative history of this discussion would reflect that it's only consultation and that there's not a requirement to agree. It's just discussed.
Well, if we wanted to do that, but what is wrong with using the words, perhaps, in this paragraph? Money is deposited in the Circuit Court Facilities Account under ORS 137-380, sub 3, may be used by the county in consultation with a local presiding judge according to a plan that was jointly developed. Do you have a problem with the jointly developed language? What's wrong with a jointly developed plan?
Mr. Chair, the interests here, Judicial Department wants what it considers to be suitable and sufficient. It wants better facilities, wants more facilities where and when they're needed.
Right.
Counties want financial relief. And
I get that. I understand that argument, but and I'll tell you the same thing that I told Judge McClure, Commissioner McClure. He's a commissioner, he's not a judge. And the same thing that I told the Chief Justice, I can't solve that problem for you. I can't solve it this session, and there's a damn good chance I'm not going to be able to solve it next session or the session after that independently from the state level. At best, maybe we're going to hope to maybe tack on at some point some bonding authority where we could have a joint program where if counties were willing to put some cash up, the states may match it with matching grants. But you've got courthouses in certain parts of this state that are historical buildings that it would cost millions and millions and millions of dollars to bring up the suitable practices, that if all we were interested in doing is providing a courtroom, we'd go out and hire a bulldozer and would knock that one down because we could build a much better facility with a lot more security for a lot less money. I don't think the state can necessarily take on all those responsibilities, so the counties have to be a player in this, just like we, the state, have to be a player in this. And I don't understand what a problem with a jointly developed plan would be, implementing a jointly developed plan. I just don't understand why that is so difficult for the counties to develop. And likewise, Brad, I don't think they ought to get necessarily a vote on how the money's spent. If you develop a plan, that's jointly developed, and then you implement it. I think in the end, that's going to be the county commission's responsibility, because judges don't get to vote because they're not part of the executive department.
Chair Williams, I don't have any problem with the language you just suggested.
Mr. Chair, this was the issue, one of a couple of issues, where our members said this is it. As long as we continue to have sole and exclusive responsibility for this obligation, we want to be the ones who make the decision as to how we do that.
But you're arguing that you don't want sole and exclusive responsibility, that you want us to essentially take over that responsibility. And to do that, I think it requires a transition. Anybody else have anything they want to say about this? Hearing is closed. Go ahead, Representative Krieger.
I had a little conversation here, but it's interesting. And if they can't come to a decision on the committee, what they're going to do, it's going to be fun to watch it when it's actually together, how well they're going to work.
Yeah.
At the end.
I agree. Okay, the last bill we've got up, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 3251.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House Bill 3251 comes to you from the Council on Court Procedures. And what it does is modify a certain requirement in the current statute that requires the Council on Court Procedures to, currently the Council on Court Procedures has to publish the rules, the amendments to the rules of civil procedure that they intend to vote on. And they usually vote the December before the legislature meets because any changes that they propose to the rules of civil procedure are then either approved or disapproved by the legislature. So currently they are required to give a 30-day comment period where they have published the proposed changes, and then they get 30 days of comments. The statute at this point requires that whatever they pass out in December is in the exact same language as it was published before the comment period, thereby rendering the comment period useless. So they request this change to removal of the exact language requirements so that they can take advantage of the comments that they get during the 30 days. And Representative Lowe is to carry.
Representative Lowe.
She said it all pretty much.
Okay. There wasn't any opposition to the bill, as I recall. Is that right? This was sort of a technical fix.
This was a technical fix, okay. And we went nine ways from Sundays. Up and down and all around trying to make everybody happy. I think in the end everybody was.
I just point out that in your packet you do have a letter from Kevin Chains from the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Oregon State Bar in support of House Bill 3251.
Yes, Representative Ringo.
If I could just raise a concern that I raised in the civil sub, and I'm not really familiar with how this council operates, and so I'm referring to those who are more, but it seems to me that if you are soliciting comments, then maybe there ought, and then after receiving those comments, you make a significant change. Maybe there should be another solicitation of comments rather than just implementing the change, because the people that originally looked at it may not have considered what the comments were. So I read that. Representative Shetterly responded, and I go ahead.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, yeah.
Binning, yes.
My response was just that
the legislature,
that's right, before these rule changes become effective, they don't become effective until the legislature meets in any event. So if somebody needs comment on a rule change after the commission has received comment, those comments and proposed further changes can always be addressed to the legislature.
If I may.
Representative Love.
Thank you. One of the things that struck me as I was sitting here listening to this tortured description of the process and how they had to go back and what the was that, you know, it's really pretty simple. Notice and comment means You give somebody an opportunity to notice, and you give them an opportunity to make comments that are meaningful and productive. And all this change does is make those comments meaningful and productive. It gives an opportunity for the comments to mean something, so that if anything fruitful comes of it, then you can avail yourself of that. It seemed like a no-brainer to me, but especially since there's sufficient oversight at the end to make it all fair.
Representative Ringo, I've had a little bit of experience with the Council on Court Procedures. One of the things we did at the end of the 95 session was to actually create a legislative advisory committee of the Council on Court Procedures so that the chairs of either the judiciary committees on matters that would be impacting something within the purview of the Council on Court Procedures could sort of pull a trigger and could activate them for a review process and to get feedback. So one of the frustrations in 95 was that we had some things that we were attempting to do in 95, and the answer was that the procedure, that the Council on Court Procedures hadn't really reviewed it, but there really wasn't, because of the way the mechanism functioned, a very good way for that to have occurred. And so we included this triggering mechanism where we could bring them in and ask them to give us some sort of an official rule or an official opinion about something we're doing. Now, I don't think we've ever done it. Did you ever do it last session, Representative Shetterly? And we haven't had any significant civil procedure bills in front of us, and so I haven't availed myself of that either. But I think there are mechanisms to address the issues you've raised. Anything else, colleagues? Representative Lowe?
Move this to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Lowe moves.
3251.
House Bill 3251. No amendments, right?
No amendments.
House Bill 3251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on her motion? Is there any objection? Shannon, why don't you call the roll?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative
Binkholz? Aye.
Representative Rico?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Me?
Oh, did you ask me too?
No. Oh. I said aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Vicki Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
I know, but I had chosen about, okay.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Sure.
Vice Chair Lowe?
Here. Aye.
Chair Williams?
Yes.
Aye. House Bill 3251 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Since I've already assigned Representative Lowe to carry the infamous UEDA bill, does anybody else want this little Council on Court Procedures change? Preferably somebody that sat in on the hearing, Representative Backlund? Okay, good. Thank you. With that, because we've done all our work so hard at other times this week in committee, we're going to have a short meeting today. We are adjourned. Thank you, everyone, for your hard work this week.